Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on pain management. Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, here to talk with you today about the pathophysiology and management of bone, abdominal, and neuropathic pain. Problems for many patients all around the world. Now, the International Association for the Study of Pain, IASP, defines pain as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage. Of course, it's not only about the normal function of the somatosensory system, but it's also about our inputs in terms of our social, spiritual, and psychological experience. Margaret McCaffrey makes it much easier when she says pain is whatever the experiencing person says it is, existing whenever that person says it does. Will you trust your patients? I certainly hope you will. So in this module, our goal is going to be to talk about the pathophysiology of pain, and then based on the causes, to talk about the strategies to control bone, abdominal, and neuropathic pain. And my take-home is always going to be treat the pain based on the underlying cause. The strategies will be very different. So let's begin to talk about the pathophysiology of pain so we can begin to understand some of the many different causes. There are two types of pain. Nociceptive pain results from the normal function of our somatosensory system. Neuropathic pain is the result of damage to that system. It actually means nerve pathology, and it's actually a disease state. When both are happening in a given patient, we would call it mixed pain. So let's start off with nociceptive pain. Normal function of our somatosensory system. When you and I started out to develop from a zygote, that single egg that was created by our mother and our father, we grew a brain. We grew a spinal cord. From that spinal cord, we develop projections that go out into our periphery. You and I are covered with axons all over our body, little nerve endings very specifically that match to a particular spot on our body. We develop projections from those nerves that were peripheral with a nerve that crosses the posterior horn of our spinal cord, and finally a third nerve that climbs into our brain, particularly ending in our thalamus. Our thalamus receives thousands of electrical pulses per second, and you and I learn that's normal. Each neuron is beating bum, 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 bum every second. Imagine the input from thousands of neurons. And again, you think that's normal. You've decided that that input is your normal experience. And most of us aren't experiencing pain from day to day. We've also developed a feedback loop that goes from our brain down to parts of our spinal cord. Malzack described the gate theory. This is about how do we actually begin to control the signals coming up towards our thalamus. Now, nociceptive pain is about a stimulus that occurs somewhere on our body. Normally, we touch ourselves, we don't feel pain, but if it becomes extreme and intense, it's painful. At the end of those little axons are nociceptors. On the surface of our body, what we call the somatic area, which includes our skin, muscle, and bone, we have pressure, chemical, and temperature receptors. Across our peritoneum and our pleura, the lining of our organs in our chest and our abdominal area, only stretch receptors. And the organs themselves don't have any nociceptors inside them. That painful stimulus is converted by those nociceptors into an electrical flux. It's a sodium-potassium flux that migrates and is transmitted along the axons towards our spinal cord. The A-delta fibers are the fastest, and you can see them here illustrated in blue, the flux going right into our spinal cord. C fibers are slower. Again, they follow along similar pathways, but create a signal that amplifies the signal already arriving at our spinal cord. Neurotransmitters carry that signal from the first neuron across to the second neuron in our spinal cord, the neurosynaptic junctions. The first response is actually within the context of an arc to stimulate the muscle, and you and I know what happens. If we hit our finger, suddenly we withdraw. What I want to remind you is that that stimulus is going to be continuous in chronic pain. No wonder people have tight muscles and may actually respond to a number of our complementary therapies. If they're in chronic spasm, a lot of touch, massage, yoga can be very beneficial. It's part of the simple neurology. The signal then moves across to the tertiary neuron and climbs towards our thalamus, where we begin to experience pain, the perception of pain. Now, if the signal's only a little bit increased, then you and I don't experience much pain. But if the signal goes way, way up, we begin to experience a lot of pain. Our bodies, in response, also generate a sympathetic response. Increased heart rate, increased blood pressure. We begin to sweat. We may also get nauseated. And of course, we have an emotional response. All part of the acute pain story. Now, based on how we're feeling, we also generate signals down that modulation pathway, and they may actually dampen or not dampen the signals coming towards our thalamus. If we're having a particularly good day, we may actually gate or close some of the signals going towards our brain. If we're having a lousy day or depressed, we may have more signals coming towards us and feel more pain. So nociceptive pain is really about a stimulus that's experienced by our nociceptors, which convert the signal or transduce it at those receptors into an electrical signal that passes along our neurons up into our brains. We perceive pain and we modulate it. Now, when there's tissue damage, and of course, if you hit your finger, you can see the swelling that ensues, can't you? Our body responds with inflammation. Inflammation is associated with edema. Part of that process is increased prostaglandins. As the white blood cells respond, we get more and more prostaglandins as part of that response. Those prostaglandins will actually sensitize the chemical nociceptors in the area of damage, and the pain signal is actually going to go up, as well as inflammation is not limited to the area of damage. If you look at your finger, you can see the swelling goes far beyond the area of damage. That inflammation, those prostaglandins, will recruit additional nociceptors in the surrounding tissues, and the pain will go up even further. So, as we think about nociceptive pain, remind ourselves, if it's somatic, it's on our skin, our muscle, and bone. That's the one sensory area where the neurons are very specific. It's easy to describe and localize, and the receptors sense changes in pressure, presence of chemicals, changes in temperature. You know, if you put your finger on the stove, yikes, or something very hot, whoa, I burned myself, and you feel it very quickly. Visceral pain, which is in our organs, remember the sensors are only stretch on our peritoneum, in our abdomen, on our pleura, in our thorax. It's much more difficult to describe because of the anatomy. Patients will often say, oh, it's in this sort of an area, but I'm not quite sure where. But as the severity goes up, they'll say it gets bigger and bigger. That's partly got to do with the anatomy of these neurons, that they map not specifically, but at multiple levels. And our brain experience is one of non-specificity. But no matter whether it's somatic or visceral, the reality is patients describe nociceptive pain typically as sharp, aching, or throbbing. Now let's talk about abdominal pain. I want to remind you that the nociceptors on our body wall, that includes our skin, muscle, and bone, are pressure, chemical, and temperature receptors. But when we move inside our abdomen or our thorax, there are no sensors in our organs. It's one of the reasons why tumors can grow in our lungs, our pancreas, our livers. We don't know it until they expand and the nociceptors on the linings of our organs, be it the peritoneum or the pleura, are then stretched and we feel uncomfortable. And of course, you know what I mean by stretch, don't you? If you have an intense bowel movement or a lot of gas, sometimes that stretch turns into cramps and you're, oh, I don't like this. Fortunately for most of us, it's transient as the gas or the bowel movement passes. But let's look at the story of John, a 54-year-old gentleman diagnosed a year ago with a hepatocellular cancer. In the last 3 months, experiencing increased abdominal distension, and along with that, a lot of bloating, diffuse abdominal discomfort. When he's sitting or standing, it's 5 out of 10. When he lies down and everything moves up, it's 6 to 7 out of 10. Along with it goes intermittent heartburn and trouble catching his breath sometimes. What do you think the cause might be? What's common with hepatocellular cancer? Well, very common is ascites. And if the ascites isn't too bad and earlier on, do we actually try to treat it by keeping the fluids moving out of our vascular space using a continuous diuretic like spironolactone? Do we help by restricting sodium? Or if it gets severe, to reduce the pain, do we actually need to do a paracentesis? These are going to be the approaches we'll use to manage the pain associated with ascites. Now, a few weeks later, John's situation progresses. More intense pain in his right upper abdomen for the last week, worse with movement and deep breaths. Every breath that he feels it. And now he's got a sharp pain in his right shoulder. What do you think the cause is? Do you remember the anatomy of what nerve goes from our diaphragm to our shoulder? The phrenic nerve. This is the result of hepatomegaly, and now the diaphragm is being irritated. There's a lot of stretch because of the size of the liver. What we're going to need to do, remember, around those tumors as an inflammatory response, is try to reduce the inflammation. And for patients with hepatomegaly with a lot of inflammation, steroids such as dexamethasone may be very effective. I'm going to typically start with a pretty high dose, 8 milligrams once a day. Never forget that the half-life is 36 to 54 hours. Biologically, we don't follow the plasma half-life for steroids. We follow the intranuclear or even into mitochondrial half-life. We can dose it once a day, and we need to, once we've established good pain control, either titrate to the lowest dose, or if we need to, even increase it a bit. Now, briefly, I want to remind you that steroids can be used for up to about 3 to 4 months, and with patients with a limited prognosis, which is often the case with a situation like John, we don't need to change the steroids. But if we're going to use them for a long period, we need to be aware of the moderate effects, which include enhanced Cushingoid features, and the worrisome is actual proximal muscle wasting, particularly in the legs, that if patients are really wasted, they can't get up out of chairs. So if patients are going to live for longer, we need to find an alternate solution. Change to another patient, Rebecca, a 49-year-old woman experiencing fatigue and anorexia. She's had a fairly rapid loss of 5 kilograms in the last 3 months. She's got abdominal discomfort, worse with eating. Later, it turns into a gnawing ache in her lower thoracic region, in the midline, radiating into her back. Worse when she lies down, better when she sits up. She's developed jaundice, and a CT scan shows a mass in the head of her pancreas and multiple small liver metastases. What do you think the cause is? If your answer was pancreatic cancer, you'd be correct. And never forget the neuroanatomy in this area. The somatosensory system comes out of our spinal cord through a plexus called the celiac plexus. It from there innervates several of our organs. And what can be most effective is a block to that celiac plexus. We can do that early. That's going to be better to avoid tumor invasion. If it's very bad, the anesthetist or the invasive radiologist isn't going to be able to get there. And it can be repeated. Now, we can also supplement the pain control with opioids as well as steroids. They can be very effective in this patient situation. Another patient, Mary, a 35-year-old with metastatic ovarian cancer. Distension, belching, anorexia, no bowel movement over the last 2 weeks, and no flatus. What does that tell you? Did you say bowel obstruction? Absolutely, and it's complete because there's no flatus, right? So she's got diffuse abdominal pain and into her pelvis, pressure associated with severe intermittent nausea, relieved by vomiting. What's the cause? Well, you're right. It's that complete bowel obstruction. So traditionally, when we have distension due to obstruction, we would have considered putting in a nasogastric tube to remove the fluids and maintaining the fluid balance for the patient with intravenous fluids. Dexamethasone could help by reducing the inflammation. Metoclopramide may increase the peristalsis, and if it's not complete, relieve the obstruction. And if necessary, we could even invite our surgeons to help us. They could offer us ostomies that could be diverting J or G tubes to actually drain the fluids from the gastrointestinal tract. But if it's really complete and we don't want surgical interventions, what else could we do? It's helpful for us to remember the normal fluid balance. If we look at this diagram, we can see that you and I, on average, put 8 to 12 liters of fluid into our gastrointestinal tract each day. A liter of saliva, our oral intake, 1, 2, or 3 liters. 1 or 2 liters from the acid secreted in our stomachs, a small amount from bile, a significant amount, often 2 or 3 liters, from our pancreas, which is producing all those digestive enzymes, as well as 2 to 3 liters from our small intestine. Now, normally our bowel takes that fluid out. It's kind of a circulation system where we put it in, but we also remove it, primarily through our jejunum and ileum, as we absorb nutrients and the fluids. The last bit of fluid is removed from that great desiccator, our colon. And typically, we only have a quarter to a half liter of fluid in our feces a day. Now, in the face of obstruction from ovarian cancer, which spreads throughout the peritoneum, it may be surgically impossible to relieve this because there is multiple levels of metastases and multiple levels of obstruction. And what becomes a problem is the fluid still there, but we can't get it out. We can't bypass it. So what are we going to think about? Well, can we actually turn off the secretion of fluids? Today, we have access to somatostatin or octreotide, as well as anticholinergic medications that can actually very effectively reduce the amount of fluid flowing into the gastrointestinal tract, reduce the stretch, and relieve the patient. The pain goes away, they stop not experiencing nausea and the vomiting. I like to use an infusion of somatostatin because the half-life is only 1.5 hours. Some people have reported Q8-hour bolus dosing, it really doesn't work. We need to use an infusion. Now, if we're going to use an anticholinergic, such as scopolamine or atropine or glycopyrrolate, the half-life is much longer, we could either do bolus dosing or infusion. And remember, if the patient's experiencing a lot of stretch from peristalsis and a lot of cramping, the opioids may be very effective here, but we don't like the slowing effect of opioids in normal patients when we get constipation. In this particular case, codeine, loperamide, diphenoxylate associated with atropine or even morphine can markedly reduce the peristalsis and stop the cramping. Now let's talk about one of the most problematic pains that a patient can experience, neuropathic pain. The International Association for the Study of Pain defines it as pain arising as a direct consequence of a lesion or disease affecting the somatosensory system. This is a disease process, not just a symptom. Although the patient experiences it, it's about pathology in the nervous system itself. There can be many different causes. Is it coming from compression or transection, infiltration, which can occur from a tumor? Is it actually ischemia because the blood supply to that particular axon or even the whole nerve has been damaged, or as we described, even the spinal cord? Or is it metabolic changes like we might see with diabetes? Typically, patient uses words like burning, electrical, shooting, stabbing, tingling, often associated with numbness, and many times the patient will even say, the pain seems to be much worse than any kind of observable injury. And it is, because the injury is inside us. Now, as I mentioned, many causes. Is it coming from the chemotherapy that you and I use? Is it coming from compression of the nerve, such as sciatica, spinal cord compression, or metastases? Could it be that the nerve itself has been affected? HIV can actually infiltrate the nerve and damage it, as well as herpes, both simplex and zoster, can be problematic. Cancer can actually invade and destroy, as we described in our bone metastases, destroying the whole structure of the medulla. Ischemia can come. Is it actually venous circulation problem? Is it the edema that's coming from venous stasis, which is actually leading to compression and destruction of the nerve? Or is it actually a primary arterial, where we actually block the blood supply to the nerve itself? Diabetes is one of the classics, which is really about lipid infiltration of the vascular structure, which leads to slow or even no blood flow, and ultimately death because of ischemia to that part of the axon. Or is it transection, simple amputation of a limb? Let's imagine a below knee or above knee amputation. We destroy the axon. We don't destroy the nerve itself. Do you remember where the nerve body is? It's right up paravertebrally. So the nerve is still alive, but the axon has been severed, and it's now going to become very erratic in its electrical conduction. So unlike nociceptive pain, where there's an observable injury, an inflammatory response, and hopefully repair, and the pain goes away, when we get neuropathic pain, there's damage to the nerve itself. It could be peripheral damage, it could be central damage, may even be damage to the sympathetic system. This is not going to go away. You and I may learn and adapt to it. So if there's an increased inputs, we may learn it's our new normal. But these patients are going to have a very different experience, probably for the rest of their lives. So now let's begin to understand some of the pathophysiology at different parts of our somatosensory system. Let's think, first of all, what can happen in terms of damage in the periphery. We could have changes right at the ends of those axons. The transduction process starts to really become dysfunctional. Why? Well, It could be in the face of damage that there's excitability of the membranes, and they're not only producing bum bum bum, but now it's bum 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 bum. Now, if you actually look at these nerves as they're coming towards our spinal cord, and all these axons are joining together, it's like a fancy electrical telephone cable, isn't it? Multiple wires, each of them with an insulator around it. In our bodies, it's Schwann cells and myelin that insulate one axon from the other. If because of the damage, demyelination occurs, suddenly two nerves are sitting on top of each other, and if this one's excited, guess what? Not only does a signal go up this nerve, but a signal goes up this nerve. So that bup, 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 bup gets amplified, and our brain experiences multiple more inputs. Now, in the face of damage out of that periphery, we actually regenerate part of our axons. We can end up with neuromas, these sort of net mesh of axons, many different nociceptors at the ends of them in different places. There can be new projections into uninjured areas, and we end up with an expanded receptive field. So a stimulus in that area is misinterpreted, and we get many more signals. We can also get, if we move along that axon, sensitization at the other end of that nerve before we get it actually producing neurotransmitters. What can happen? Well, in the face of a lot of electrical inputs, it turns out we can get increased expression of sodium channels, many more sodium channels than we had before. So we can also get increased expression of calcium channels. These are voltage-gated channels, which in the face of stimulation, the charge changes, calcium enters, and releases more neurotransmitters. So now we've got more electrical stimulation through the neurosynapsis of the subsequent neurons. Increased substance P, glutamate, and other neurotransmitters. So now let's move beyond that peripheral axon into the spinal cord and think about the central mechanisms that may be causing pain. We call this central sensitization. It's on the other side of the neurosynaptic junctions. It turns out we have receptors that have only relatively recently been discovered called NMDA receptors, or norethyl D-aspartate. These are normally inactive in our bodies, and they're blocked by magnesium. But in the face of increased neurotransmitters, particularly the glutamate and glycine, again, there are changes to the charge in that receptor. The magnesium is released, the channel opens and becomes active. This leads to decreased opioid responsiveness. Although we may have been using morphine, it doesn't have as much of an effect as it had before, as well as we get two pathognomonic phenomenon, allodynia and hyperalgesia. And let's talk about those. So if I actually draw a curve of what happens if I, in a particular part on my body, increase the stimulus, this graphic shows us that as the stimulus intensity goes up, while I may have only thought of it as a normal sort of pressure, suddenly I start to experience pain, and with increasing stimulus, the pain gets more intense. In the face of injury, that curve moves to the left. Now, a given stimulus produces much more pain. Hyperalgesia is more pain from a given stimulus. It's about increased sensitivity to that stimulus. Allodynia, on the other hand, is pain in response to a stimulus that wouldn't previously have been painful. The best example I can give you is the patient in bed. They've had bed sheets on their feet for all their lives. And now they're saying to us, please don't put anything on my feet. They're so painful. Or maybe it's the woman who has chest wall disease from her breast cancer and she can't stand clothing on her body. Clothes and bed sheets weren't previously painful. Now they can be excruciating. This is central sensitization. Now let's think about how we're going to manage the pain that comes from either central or peripheral sensitization and the damage that goes along with neuropathic pain. What I want to say from the outset is there's very little research in this area. The ideas that we're going to be talking about have mostly been extrapolated from non-cancer pain situations, particularly diabetic peripheral neuropathy, and you'll be seeing DPN on the slides, as well as postherpetic neuralgia, and you'll be seeing PHN on the slides. There are actually very few randomized control trials, including in these areas, very few comparative trials, and what ends up happening is based on what we think is going on in the patient, particular patient's pathophysiology, we then make a choice of where to start. Fortunately, common patterns lead to good interventions if we follow particular strategies. So let's begin to think about John, a 62-year-old gentleman presenting with cough and weight loss and discovered to have a non-smell small cell cancer of the lung in his right upper lung. He gets some chemotherapy, cisplatin-based, and ultimately develops peripheral neuropathy, both in his stocking area, in his legs, as well as gloves along his hands and arms. He describes it as 4 out of 10, and he's experiencing hyperalgesia. Anything that touches him in that area is more painful now than it would have been before. So, what do we know? We know that chemotherapy, particularly the platins, the taxanes, and vinca alkaloids, can actually affect the neurons. Not only the cell body, the axonal transport system, but they can damage the myelin sheath and even the glial support structure. These medications can lead to burning in the periphery that is protracted and may go on forever. So it turns out, if we have chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy, or even the peripheral neuropathy that comes from the vascular damage associated with diabetes, the gabapentinoids are a very good choice. They work at those calcium channels to block them, so we don't get nearly as much neurotransmitter produced, and there are actually some positive randomized controlled trials. Both of gabapentin and pregabalin, you can see the results here. They've been effective for both of them in diabetic peripheral neuropathy, postherpetic neuralgia. We can see in cancer pain, the gabapentin's been useful. And even in fibromyalgia, the pregabalin has been helpful. Now, if we were to compare these with an older analgesic, the tricyclics, they're not as favorable in terms of the response, but they are better in terms of their safety. They're not hepatically metabolized, there's no drug interactions, and the side effects are well tolerated. Many people like to think about using pregabalin. Certainly, it's easier to titrate, faster onset, better in terms of reducing anxiety and improving sleep. But the problem is, it's still expensive. So, I actually like to start, for many patients who can't afford the pregabalin, with gabapentin. We start with low dose, often at bedtime, titrate by increasing it every 8 hours, and often need to get up into the higher range. We can go as high as 3,600 to 5,400 milligrams every 24 hours. Now, no doubt, pregabalin's very effective. If the gabapentin hasn't worked, the pregabalin might, and you can see the dosing here on the slide, much lower doses, potentially helping the patient get good pain control, even in the face of their peripheral neuropathy. So now let's focus on the action of antidepressants that we mentioned in the last section. They actually work on the modulation pathway, and they actually affect noradrenaline and serotonin. Amitriptyline, which has been around for years, was our first choice, and that was what was available. We saw it was very effective, even in low dose. Subsequently, we developed dazipramine, nortriptyline, imipramine. They're a little less effective, but as we'll see, have less side effects. And we've now got SNRIs such as duloxetine and venlafaxine, which can be very effective in this type of neuropathic pain, as well as the SSRIs, maybe less effective, but also less side effects. So what about those side effects? Well, the first generation can be very problematic as we increase the dose, very significant anticholinergic effects causing nausea and a variety of other unpleasant experiences for the patient, dry mouth, etc. Second generation aren't as potent in terms of their side effects, and you can see the SSRIs and SNRIs are better. The problem with them is, particularly in males, they can cause very unwanted sexual dysfunction. So where does that leave us? We like to land in the middle if we're going to use tricyclic antidepressants, and I must admit, I don't use them very often these days. I'll start off with either the second generation, dazipramine, nortriptyline, imipramine, or I'll even start with duloxetine or venlafaxine. And for both of the latter, we actually have positive clinical trials. So what about the dosing? With the tricyclics, we typically use much less of a dose for analgesia than we do for depression. We often start at 10 to 25 milligrams at bedtime. Because of the half-life, which is up to 24 hours, we can only increase the dose after five half-lives once we get to steady state, and that's going to be every 3 to 5 days. So it's going to take us a while to get into the therapeutic range for many of our patients. We could increase the dose above 100 milligrams at bedtime, but at that point we start to need to measure blood levels to assess for risk of toxicity. There's no doubt if there's no risk, we can continue to actually increase the dose. And some patients are relatively rapid metabolizers and will tolerate a higher dose. So think about tricyclic antidepressants, but maybe there are other alternatives. So we've talked about the management of peripheral neuropathy. Now let's talk about the management of that shooting pain that tends to go down people's legs, whether it's a disc or sciatica. It's that sharp electrical stabbing pain. Anticonvulsants might be very effective for this type of pain because anticonvulsants, just like they change the excitation in our brains, can actually change the excitation of those peripheral neurons, reduce the sodium-potassium flux, and dampen that pain experience. There's actually very limited data, so it's really trial and error. Historically, many people have used carbamazepine, sodium valproate. I've tried phenytoin, but I didn't think it was very effective. But today, I'm more inclined to use the newer generation anticonvulsants because they have less side effects. There's actually no clear data about their effectiveness, but anecdotally, I've seen several of them are more effective at reducing that shooting pain and with less side effects. Now, if you're going to use carbamazepine, the older medication, we start at a low dose, we dose it twice a day, and increase it every 2 to 3 days because its half-life is 12 hours. There is no doubt, as we're increasing it, we need to watch for toxicity by monitoring blood levels. Certainly worthwhile trying anticonvulsants. They're one approach to that shooting pain that comes from the disc, sciatica, maybe even the metastases. So we've talked about strategies to impact what might be happening in the periphery. What about centrally? Well, you and I have been using opioids for years, and they can have a very significant effect. Let's think about John again. 3 months later, now he's got 2-week history of forearm stabbing, elbow pain, and severe aching. He's got increased burning in his hand. We've already optimized the gabapentin, but his pain is 8 out of 10. And we've discovered that he's got an increased apical mass causing a plexopathy. He's got a mixed picture of nociceptive and neuropathic pain. We know that opioids are very effective for nociceptive pain, but they can also be very effective with neuropathic pain. In fact, several experts would say they might be first line for moderate to severe neuropathic pain. I will admit, personally, I might try some of the other strategies first, but then I'll add these and titrate to effect, the same way I would do with nociceptive pain. What I'm aware of is, if they're not really very effective, it's probably neuropathic pain, and I think need to think about an alternative to my classic morphine or oxycodone or hydromorphone. Now, there are several positive trials. We can see morphine has been helpful in postherpetic neuralgia, oxycodone in both diabetic as well as postherpetic neuralgia. Methadone, and we'll talk about that in a moment, is very useful in mixed neuropathic pain, etc. Even combinations, morphine, gabapentin versus morphine alone versus gabapentin alone, very effective. And maybe there's value even from some tramadol. But what about that methadone? This is an old medication that we now understand much better than ever before. It's a mixed mu receptor agonist, so it works like morphine, but it's also an NMDA receptor antagonist. And what did we say was happening? As we get a lot of neurotransmitters, the magnesium flows out of the NMDA receptor channel and it becomes active. Very common with neuropathic pain. So we can use this single product to actually titrate to effect, again, or side effects, but the kinetics of this medication are very different. It has a very long half-life, 5 to 7 days. It does not follow first-order kinetics, and I'm going to recommend that you start using it in partnership with either a palliative medicine or a pain management specialist who has had experience. Because of the side effects, yes, while there are approaches to opioid rotation, and some people enjoy that, I personally prefer using methadone as a co-analgesic. If I've been using morphine already, I'll actually add the methadone to that in very low dose, 2.5 to 5 milligrams every 12 or every 8 hours, and then slowly increase it. But remember, with the half-life of 5 to 7 days, I need to do an increase every 25 to 35 days. There's no doubt that the cost is very preferential. It's very inexpensive in most settings, and oral is less expensive than the parenteral. Now, in addition to the opioids, we might also consider the corticosteroids. We know that every solid tumor has an inflammatory response associated with it. It's got edema. What's been shown is even when we're thinking it's nerve damage, part of that pain production may be this inflammatory response. I've used it in bone, neuropathic pain, lymphedema, and a variety of other conditions. Again, start with a moderate dose of 8 milligrams once a day. That has to do with a very low risk of early side effects, and titrate to effect. And never forget, we can continue this for 2 or 3 months. In patients with a long survival, we're going to need to consider rotating to something else. So we've been talking about a variety of relatively conventional therapies that we might use to manage neuropathic pain, but sometimes we don't get the results we're hoping for. So let's talk about the value of lidocaine and some other medications. Back to John. It's a week later. He has burning, stabbing pain, still not well controlled. 7 out of 10. And allodynia. He can't stand the bed sheets and he doesn't like his clothing, particularly in his periphery. We've already got him on gabapentin, morphine, and some methadone as a coanalgesic, as well as dexamethasone. What to do next? My suggestion is, as it's now complex, call one of your pain or palliative medicine specialists who have some ideas about particularly newer medications where the results are variable and we don't necessarily use them that frequently. Let's start with the sodium channel blockers, of which lidocaine is our best example. There are actually a few randomized controlled trials in neuropathic pain, suggesting that if we use a loading dose and it has an effect, that we might actually use an infusion. Some patients get pretty good responses and ultimately could be converted to an oral sodium channel blocker such as mexiletine. The important thing with this particular medication is that you and I need to manage the pain and monitor for side effects. As the concentration goes up in the plasma, so does the risk of side effects. We need to actually do therapeutic blood level monitoring 8 to 10 hours after the start of the infusion. Some patients will get a good response with this particular approach. But in my experience, ketamine may be a more effective agent. It's newer. We now know that it actually blocks the NMDA receptor. Randomized controlled trials using ketamine in combination with opioids, either a single bolus or opioids, have had generally positive results, and it's both water and lipid soluble, so we can use it in many different formats. We found it to be very effective given orally because the parent product is metabolized in the liver into a more potent analgesic, and particularly for mucositis, low dose given every 8 hours has been very effective for many patients. We've also used it subcutaneously in wound care when the topical lidocaine isn't enough. And we've seen that infusions in some patients with extreme pain, the worst in my experience has been sacral plexus invasion, actually can be fairly well controlled with that infusion. The important thing is to look for side effects and maybe be preemptive, use an antisialagogue for excessive secretions, and maybe a bit of benzodiazepine to reduce those dysphoric feelings. So we've talked about a variety of medications that can manage both nociceptive and neuropathic pain. Important thing to recognize is there may be others that can be effective as well. Pharmacologically, we might use topical capsaicin, topical lidocaine, the patches, or even ketamine. New evidence is coming forth about the effectiveness of cannabinoids, particularly when they impact the CBD receptors, baclofen, and alpha-adrenergic agents such as clonidine. But I never want you to forget the value of non-pharmacological and interventional anesthesia. Remember that first response is muscle contraction. Is the patient actually experiencing chronic muscle contraction and pain causing the contractions to be even worse? Touch, massage, acupuncture, yoga, will they help to reposition the patient to relax those muscles and may actually reduce the pain considerably? Aromatherapy, counseling, transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation, biofeedback have all been shown to be effective. Think about how we can put this package together, and particularly in the patient where we've tried all sorts of medications and they haven't worked that well, never forget total pain. Is the nociceptive or the neuropathic pain, as we're thinking about it, actually the result of psychological, social, and spiritual suffering? There is no doubt. By understanding the cause, we can then effectively choose analgesics and co-analgesics and manage most of our patient's pain experience. And if we use the pharmacokinetics, we can control it safely and rapidly. But it's complex. It's a frontier still, and we will learn more in the coming years. Success with your patients. I hope you get their pain under control quickly and safely.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends so you don't miss any of our new content. make sure you are subscribing to PCIC Podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.